Why are police photographing our license plate?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello, this is The Reasonable Voice, where everything is political and all our problems are due to a lack of education. We look into the arts, finance, and humanities to learn the solutions, and we invite our guests to suggest their solutions. The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves, so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, The Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. My guest today is poet excellence, Ebony Walden. And, well, first of all, hello, Ebony. How are you today?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Ebony and I have at least in common Queens, New York. I used to live in Queens.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And of course, I didn't live on Long Island, but went out there a lot to visit friends. I did live on Shelter Island, if that counts. where did you live in Queens?
I grew up in Jamaica, Queens, if you know.
Sure.
I grew up in Queens.
Yeah, and I only went to New York as an adult after college and whatever, but I lived in Forest Hills for a good while. Loved the E&F train until, you know, it was fabulous until, as you know, it was a problem. And then it wasn't fabulous, and there you were stuck. So I did move into the city and had no regrets with that, but I loved Queens. I loved Queens because you walk everywhere in New York, but in Queens, to start out your day, walking to the E and F train. Anyway, we digress. We are here to talk about changing the world, one person at a time, by storytelling. Now, if you wonder about that, Ebony is going to tell you all about it. You are, I shouldn't even say just one person at a time, although that's the cliche, and I feel Ebony has done that. But really, she's working by city by city. Let me let you talk. You're telling the story of working for the city, and the city you're working for right now is Charlottesville, Virginia. Yes.
Yes, I've worked for the city of Charlottesville and working there for about 8 years now.
But how many years?
8.
Wow. But you have also traveled the world to 17 countries or something like that?
That is correct. In the middle of I'm working there, I went on an around the world trip. I traveled for 8 months, 17 countries, probably 60 or 70 towns, villages, cities, and the like. It was quite a world.
And what made you do that? You sound and look like a young person. Did you just get the urge, or was there a life-changing event, or what started you down that road?
It's always an interesting conversation. It started from a friend of mine who, it was the summer of 2009, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And we're friends that just kind of throw ideas around. They called me up in Ebony. He was like, I'm gonna shock you. I think I'm gonna go around the world. I turned 30 this year, or I'm, you know, getting up there, and it's a good time for me to take a break in my current career. I've been there for a couple years, and I have some money saved. I think I'm gonna go on an around the world trip.
And
then we talked for about an hour or so, and by the time I had those same factors in my life that were key, and by the time I had convinced him it was a good idea, and got off the phone, I said, well, I should do that. You know, I'm young. I was actually about to turn 30 the next year.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was in a time I had been in my job maybe 3 or 4 years that time. I was like, okay, I could, you know, stop here and, you know, have a break and travel, and I had some money saved. And I said, well, why don't I think about doing it? And everywhere I went, kind of like once you put it out there, everything conspired 9 months later, I was getting on, maybe like 9 or 10 months later, I was getting on a plane.
Wow. Now you know, this all sort of led to a infusing poetry and place.
Right.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Sure. So I'm a city planner. That's one. That's the lens in which I look at like cities and places and how they support people, and vice versa. But I'm also, at that time, I was a poet in hosting poetry events. And so I'm not one to just travel around the world because I'm young and free. I like to do things with a sense of purpose about them. And so I knew I just didn't want to travel and sightsee, but I wanted to tell a story of the people that I saw around the world, my own story. And so I was like, why don't I travel? I was just getting deep into the poetry scene, hosting these events, and I was like, I don't want to leave that. I really want to use that as a jumping off point.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, why don't I challenge myself to travel? Own my craft by writing poetry about everything I'm seeing, feeling, hearing, the people I encounter, so I can kind of encapsulize this trip using this art and then telling the story of those people. And from a spiritual perspective, you know, both, you know, what's beautiful about the world and what's broken about the world. And so those were the kind of the tale of two cities, or the upside of the world with beauty about it, beautiful, and then what's broken. So I traveled, I put together like kind of these mini workshops where I would also try to do poetry with other people and host a couple events and workshops with kids. So I traveled, I volunteered, I sightsaw as well, but more than half of my trip was volunteering in schools, community centers, and orphanages in the places around the world that lend themselves to that.
And you sort of collected these experiences and these travels as making a poetic scrapbook, if you will, a poetic record. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, no, I had a website. It was called the Poetic Justice World Tour. I wanted to give voice to what I was seeing, give voice to the voiceless as I was seeing it around the world, to write poetry about what I was seeing. I had a blog, so you could travel around me where I posted my experiences in blog form, but I also, you know, posted poetry as well, and took some videos, and so it was multimedia trip where I had pictures, I had videos, had poetry in my blog, you know, to kind of update people and encapsulize this trip as I was going around the world. So you could see the slums of the world, and you can also see, you know, me at the Great Wall of China.
Yes.
And, you know, varying poetry about those things in between.
So it sort of became your vocation, if you will, to use your travels and your poetry to make or suggest or to influence a systemic renewal to communities that you travel to, or to Charlottesville, or both?
Well, I really wanted to see, it was kind of like to see what was going on, to report back, to bring that experience back with me, and use art as a means by which to communicate that which I saw. Then also use art as a means to connect with the people that I saw. Like I said, I had this one poem that I did all around the world, people. I was in Kenya, and I did a poetry workshop with kids there. And in all the different places, I tried to do, you know, language is slightly better, but I tried to do a little bit of poetry because I think art is a wonderful way to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a wonderful way to give voice to people that don't necessarily have a voice. So we can hear about, you know, what's important or what's life like from the words of somebody in a Kenyan slum from their particular perspective. So not only from my perspective, but what are these kids writing about? What are they seeing? What are they feeling? What does life taste like here? You can use that particular metaphor. So I use other people's words and then my own words to kind of give my friends and family and whoever was following a clearer picture of the dichotomy of the world and what kind of injustices we're going, what kind of beauty and spirit and joy amongst even amongst or in throughout that hardship. Especially to show that dichotomy through poetry and using poetry means to really communicate and help people find their voice and use it.
And you, I know you went to George Washington, right? Georgetown University. Did you, did your work there inspire this, or was it something after university?
I think that I've always had a heart for service and social justice. I mean, I grew up fairly poor in New York, where there is very visible dichotomy and systemic both racism, and then you can really see, you know, the two cities and economically. But that was always a part of my life, and, you know, going to Georgetown was kind of a stark difference in that reality. So I feel that tension in my own life.
Uh-huh.
And that's the lens by which I look through life. My time at Georgetown was really important. It's a Jesuit school, and they're real focus on volunteer and public service.
Uh-huh.
So I spent my employment while in school through the Volunteer and Public Service Center, tutoring, mentoring, working with adjudicated youth. And so that's been a consistent theme really throughout my life, is going to the places that are poor and marginalized and mm-hmm. working there. And so I wanted that continuation to be a part of my trip, you know, even in the city that I live in, been involved in working with youth, particularly minority youth from lower income backgrounds, because I feel like that's just my heart and soul of giving back in that sense. And so I took who I was, a poet and one who always wants to go to the marginalized and not only serve, but just be a part of those particular communities and see it, what life is like, because I think that that really forms your, even if you're not in those areas, really informs how you grow and your perspective as a human being. So I always want to be growing in those areas and seeing life more clearly and from other perspectives.
I see. Did you, you know, you mentioned spirituality a great deal. Did you did you sort of grow up going to church, and that was an influence as well on your life?
No, I didn't grow up going to church, but faith is praying grandmothers. That was always a part of my experience, not necessarily directly when I was growing up, but indirectly.
Gotcha.
But my faith experience was really strengthened at Georgetown.
Uh-huh.
That's really where I became a Christian and started going to church. And then more so as I lived in Charlottesville, to really, I think it became important. And also fueled by my faith, where, like, it was important for me to be a part of the city of Savannah, really, because I wanted to be Nehemiah and go rebuild the ruins and be a part of the city
mm-hmm.
and keep the peace of the city. But those were key things that are important to me, not only as my vocation, but going around the world and interacting with cities. To me, are places where people can thrive. And, my sort of vocational goal, if I would have one, really is to create better cities where everybody can thrive. And so that's the lens by which I look at life, and that kind of fuels me. That kind of faith always fuels me in helping those in need. And being a good neighbor, I think, is kind of what it boils down to. And my trip really around allowed me to be a good global neighbor.
Hmm. I'd say that's putting it mildly. You actually, part of your contribution to helping cities plan to be better cities and serve all of the community, you do story gathering. Tell us about that.
Well, that was kind of part of my trip. I think that it's kind of who I am as a person, more so than it's actually a project. So around the world, I did this kind of script poem where I got people to kind of tell their story by using a poem.
Uh-huh.
And maybe I got somebody from, like, one of every country I went to. It's kind of called Where I'm From poem, to get a good flavor of, like, what are the hardships, what are the joys, what are the kind of food, what kind of music, what kind of culture people have around the world. And so I took, and I'm interested in people anyway. I'm always trying to understand people and get their stories, because I think people are inherently interesting, and so that's who I am as a person. That's the model I went around the trip with, is trying to, more in a metaphorical sense, collect stories of people, places, and that comes out in some of my poetry and also in some of the kind of video footage that I took, kind of tells the story of me going around the world and other people telling their own story on a basic level in kind of 1 minute using poetry. So that's kind of the one of the tools I use as I was traveling.
So did you find that, first of all, did the people write a sort of a 60-second poem about themselves? Did they do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I got maybe like 15 or 16 people from around the world.
Wow.
And it's basically a script.
Uh-huh.
And you go, it's kind of fill in the blank, I am from, and you go, you know, what are some names of people in your family? What are some your favorite foods? What are the music traditions? And you name two or three of those. It's like six different categories.
Sure.
And it takes like 30 seconds to read. And so I would help them, and I got people from, I don't know, Kenya and India and South Africa and Australia and Peru, just to kind of do this thing. And it's kind of really cool, more than it's really, you know, poetic skill. It kind of just uses that template to tell the story, and you get to see the differences, but you also see similarities of like, you know, one of them is like, what was your accomplishment or greatest joy in life? Most of it has to do with people having children or something beautiful happening in their family. And the saddest things are usually tragedies or somebody close to them dying. And oddly enough, everybody likes pizza as a food for a lot of people.
What's so odd about that?
Everybody was like, pizza. And I'm like, okay, what about food from your culture? And I was like, oh, we've influenced so much. And so you just see these similarities and differences and then some phrases, you know, and you collect these odd phrases from around the world and you're like, what? If somebody who isn't me looking at this would be like, what are they talking about? But it's just this odd collection of different people and putting, you know, their highs and lows and favorites and stories in from their youth and from who they are, a piece of paper, and saying, this is where I'm from.
Well, you know, it sounds like to me that you're being extremely modest. It sounds like to me what has happened is you have gone to many different countries, many different cultures, and within those different cultures you have reached out and had a response from many different socioeconomic levels, and those people have come together through poetry to tell their story, and that story shows and recognizes and I guess respects the differences, but it also tells how similar we are. It's a glue factor, if you will. It brings us together, even if it's a thing like pizza, but certainly the joys of life and the tragedies of life we share in common. And what you're doing, it must make your audience, they must come to that realization. They must have an oh my god kind of aha experience, don't you think?
I hope so. I've done a couple of presentations in town, and I've been back 3 years, so it seems like a long time ago, but that's really what I came back thinking. But it's like, you know, we are more alike than we are different. Everybody has some of the same human longings to belong, to have a family, to have work that they thought was meaningful and purposeful, the sense of freedom, to have a home, to be a part of a community, to add something good and beautiful to life in the world. Hospitality was huge, and eating and meals, and everybody drank tea. I mean, so I saw differences, but the essence of being human and those deep human longings, you know, what makes us laugh and what makes us cry, although there's a lot of cultural nuance to that, were a lot of the same things. And I would hope that, you know, the presentations, so I have this on a kind of big presentation where I put this photo exhibit of my around the world trip and kind of took people through poetry and pictures on my route, and then read poems, and then I did a presentation, and that was just kind of at the end was my presentation, and that was just like one of the top five lessons I learned. It's like we're just one, you know, kind of human family that everybody bleeds red and essentially cries at the same things and laughs at a lot of the same things. Mm. I guess it was just the range of human experience.
Yes.
I feel it was really an education for me. And then I'm sure it's wonderful for people to be able to vicariously experience the world through my pictures, because I had 7,000 pictures.
Wow.
So for my exhibit, well, there was a formal part of my exhibit where I was trying to sell some pictures to raise money for some of these different places I volunteered at.
Sure.
So I had to take 7,000 pictures, and I took my 24 that I wanted to sell or to be on display.
Wow.
Which was a crazy job. But then, you know, I had the more artistic thing where I had the continents drawn out, different people and places and poems I got from that. So that was like maybe still trying to get it down to maybe I had 150 pictures total,
uh-huh.
7,000 to 150. But if you followed me around the world and my different perspectives, you would say, wow, not only about what was beautiful about the world, but what was really broken about it. Like walking
yes.
through slums and walking by sewage in the slums and, you know, just in the dichotomy of, like, that was the place that I had the best hospitality, and interacting with the kids was wonderful. They were probably the best poetry workshop with kids that
yes.
I've seen, and they were so spirited. And so you have this dichotomy everywhere you want, and to be able to be present with that and embrace that, because that's just kind of how life is everywhere on varying levels. So I hope that that's what people got from my presentation and poems, and
well,
this lightness of the world and then this heaviness of the world.
Yes, and we're going to take a break now and listen to some
okay.
of your poetry. My guest today is Ebony Walden, who infuses poetry and place. So don't go away. We'll be right back. And while we're gone, we're going to hear Ebony Walden perform a poem. Stay with us.
Are women really the weaker sex? Because all I've seen are brave shoulders, gracefully carrying the bulk of the world's burdens, in hearts full of hurt and expectation, on heads that balance the substance of the community, and bundled babies held on backs that bend but don't break.
Welcome back. This is The Reasonable Voice, Blog Talk Radio. The Reasonable Voice is in the studio with me today, Mr. Bernard Hankins and Michelle Opperman and Daniel L. Garner. Our guest today is Ebony Walden, a world-traveling poet and videographer and still photography, trying to to get the world to see itself as it is, the blemishes and the successes, the joys, the tragedies, and pizza. So welcome back. I was just wondering, because we've touched on so many things, and it's just the more we say it, or the more you say, it seems to be bigger than one thinks on the surface. This poetry and place. You do an open mic where people tell their stories. Is that an ongoing thing? Is that going to happen in Charlottesville, for instance?
Well, it used to happen. I used to host it a while back. I stopped when I went on my around the world trip, and I've been taking a sabbatical since. But the
gotcha.
Essence of that was essentially the same. A
okay.
space where people can come in and tell their stories and use poetry or music or those particular, or if they want to rap, or if they want to do some prose, telling their story and using their voice to communicate, you know, whom they are and what their experience has been. Yes, that was the essence of that.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that in a bit, but first, the two things that you, I think, are most associated with, if my information is correct, as we speak. One is the Trinity Presbyterian Church in Charlottesville, and the other is that you work for the city of Charlottesville. Can you talk to us about how what you do as an individual, married to Trinity Presbyterian and then married to the city of Charlottesville, how does that all come together for you and poetry?
Sure. Yeah, and I started off at Trinity, the Trinity Fellows Program. I go to All Souls Charlottesville now. But I think the Trinity Fellows Program is why I came to Charlottesville. It was important, both in my vocation and what I do now. It was a fellowship to really help young Christians think about their vocation,
uh-huh.
to think about their vocation, who they are, how they were going to serve their world in Christ, in their community, by using their vocation. And so I think that I've taken that with me around the world, and that's really kind of informed my view of the world, is how I love God and love the city and love the things I love by being me and doing them well. So as a city planner, I see myself as seeking the peace and the welfare of the city.
Uh-huh.
And those come, you know, directly from Scripture, and rebuilding the ruins of the city and making sure it's a place where everybody can flourish. That's why I went into city planning, and hopefully that's a measure of which I do at my job now, making sure we have safe streets and good housing and enough greenery and enough trees.
Yeah.
And even programmatically in some areas, you know, as a city planner, one of the things that we're charged with is creating a comprehensive plan, which is a 25-year plan for the entire city. We update that every 5 years. So I've been with the city on two cycles of updating that. When we look at economics, we look at housing, we look at transportation, we look at our historic resources, we look at our environment and get a snapshot of where we are, and then we go confer with the community and then try to figure out goals and objectives and strategies of where we want to be. So I'm intimately involved in helping the community create that vision of a better Charlottesville tomorrow, and also working with the resources that we have now, just kind of the quality of life of the place. And that, to me, is a deeply spiritual, because it came out of that. I got into the whole profession because I was interested in place and renewal, and having the beauty of place be available to everybody, because you can live in a horrible place and really that affect who you are and your opportunities. Not horrible as anything, but the things we think that are good for community, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of crime or even a lot of traffic maybe, or basic things where you can't get around, or you don't have access to the resources or public transportations, or a particular set of the community feels isolated. Those are things that, you know, we think about as an urban planner. How does the community have more access? How can we be more connected? How can this segment of the population be more connected from varying levels? So mm-hmm. for me, that's a deeply spiritual thing.
That's a very interesting, I don't want to trivialize it, and it sounds like that's not what I'm trying to say, but it is to come at city planning from a spiritual and poetic direction or point of view. I think that's kind of unique. I mean, I don't know that I've ever heard a city planner put it that way. How, besides the obvious, how does that make you do your job differently?
Well, I think hopefully I'm doing all things as if I'm doing them for Christ. I think that, you know, sometimes like any other job, it's hard from day to day because you're dealing with a lot of details and minutiae and just your job.
Yeah.
But when I step back and I do things like this and I remember, why did I get into this? I got
yeah.
into this because I'm interested in place and I'm interested in people and I want to make cities better.
Yeah.
So when I stepped into that, and it's all of the small decisions that you make about how many trees are we going to have here, or how wide this row is here, do we have crosswalks here, do bus routes go here, not go here, do we have enough open space? All of the small decisions that you make that get up to the larger whole that is the city, I have to hopefully believe that that is important. And some days, to tell you the honest truth, it doesn't seem like it. Mm. But then when I'm able to step back and remember, like, why did I get into this? Mm-hmm. Change and meld over time as my career changes. But hopefully I sense of that. Like, these things sometimes seem trivial, but in conjunction, and I've seen some of the cities I've visited around the world are the most, for me anyway, the most disorderly places, and it really has a effect on people's lives.
Yes.
And their livelihood. And so I know that from just traveling and just being here, you know, the livelihood of the city. And that's really what the poetry piece was important to me. Like, just the place and the placement of things are important, but the actual, the soft things of the city are important too. Was there a space, you know, and that's why I did the poetry jams for about a year. Was there a space for people of all races, ages, socioeconomic backgrounds to come into one room and to share their stories? I found a place really like that in all the places that I've been, that people are able to cut, and very few churches I've been to do, can everybody come in and feel comfortable and feel like they have something. And everybody gets their 5 minutes of fame, and everybody has to encourage and clap for that. That's the kind of space I want to create, or wanted to create, because that to me was a kingdom space.
Wow.
What the kingdom of God looks like is everybody coming together in one space to share who they are with one another, both the beauty of it and what's broken about their lives. And so that really gave me a springboard for the ideas of the themes I wanted to go around the world and look out as. And even as a planner, you know, you think about what's beautiful about our city and what do we like, what's not beautiful, and what do we want to change.
Yes. Well, and also, which I didn't mention, but of course you've been talking about, is that you also bring an international point of view. You have seen many cities, I think we said 70 cities around the world, and been doing this kind of, can we come together with poetry and pizza and find out what is working and what isn't, and then you bring that experience back on so many levels to Charlottesville. Did you live in Charlottesville prior to your world tour?
I did. I've been living in Charlottesville for a little bit over 10 years now.
Oh, wow. You know,
I
have to say, I actually have been, I've been here longer than I realized. I'm a New Yorker still at heart. I lived in and worked in New York in television and theater primarily for, oh, I guess a quarter of a century. And I would like to tell people I married the University of Virginia, so I had to stay. I came to see a performance of the Auditorial Society and met my now wife, who is a studio professor at the University of Virginia, and she's tenured, and I went, oh, that's great, that's wonderful. Okay, when do we go back to New York? And she said, no, I'm tenured. But by that time, I was hooked. I love history, so that certainly helped, and love my wife, and heavens, half the people live down here from New York, so I'm hardly homesick. But I'm wondering, as I've met people like Mayor Hooja and Vice Mayor Kristen and Albemarle County, Ann Malik, and of course, Maurice Jones, well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I kept thinking of you as a poet, which I should, but this whole city planner thing, even though I knew it, you know, it didn't hit me like she's been around the world, all these countries and cities, and she's finding these people and they're doing the creating poetry together and finding out their likes and dislikes and differences and similarities, but and all of that, of course, is impressive. But now you're saying city planner, and I'm going, wow, how wonderful to have someone with that expertise and experience in that kind of position. So now I'm going to give you all that to say, when I arrived in Charlottesville as a guy who had a reasonably successful career on national television, at least soap operas, and directing a lot of off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway theater and a lot of original work, I got here to Charlottesville and immediately, of course, started looking for places where I could do what I do. And part of that journey made me come to the conclusion that Charlottesville was two cities, one of which I knew a lot about because it's in the history books, and people come here from all over the world to see Monticello and Ashland and Montpelier and the vineyards and Richmond and so forth. But the other city, and I'll tell you how I noticed it, that other place, is because when I started to introduce original works here and I needed performers of color, it was very difficult to find any. And I've discussed this with all the city names I've mentioned before. I'm asking you this question, but tell me about how, well, first of all, do you think I'm off my rocker, or did you get that impression ever, or and how
no,
does that...
No, to be quite honest, this is the whitest place I've ever lived.
Well, then, okay. Well, then, there it is.
I'm a fairly blunt person, but to be put it in short words, yes.
Yes. So is part of being a city planner, especially one with international experience of cities all around the world, and then you come back and you see this in some places quite divided by actual physical railroad tracks.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, well, you know, I've done a lot of work. I actually just finished a video for the Jefferson School City Center, and I also did the video in 2011 before they did all of the renovation and restoration. How does one go from the leveling of Venker Hill to fighting over the Western Bypass because of a historic cemetery and family? How do you juggle all of that? Because that's a lot. In
well,
the city of Charlottesville.
That, I think that probably not even my international experience, but even my experience as a city planner, and just as a person living in Charlottesville, I've been to a couple different churches. I feel like I have my foot in so many different arenas, and I think that's really why the poetry events worked. Because I knew people that lived in public housing projects, but I also knew people that were like city councilors, and I knew people at UVA, and I knew people from all really different walks of Charlottesville's community, and that really helps me out a lot, because you can't, and even traveling the world, I would say you really can't stay in one particular perspective.
Yes.
And just my job in and of itself, I have to juggle people. So I have to work with the citizens and totally different type of citizens. And I have to work with our boards and commissions. And I have to work with, you know, my department, which is full of all different type of people, from engineers to building inspectors to planners like myself, to working with developers and architects and engineers. So part of my job really is being this person that is able to talk to all those different type of people. And I think my world travels have really deepened that ability to be present with who is in front of me.
Yes.
And to really relate to them. I feel like I'm a relatable kind of person because I feel like I'm authentic.
Yeah.
So, and that ability has only deepened as I've traveled, because I had to be present as I was going to all these different countries and people, and to be able to adjust, to be able to appreciate who and what they were and their culture were, and to ingest that.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that's what I bring to my job. And even in the future, as I think about earlier, I think I want to be one who brings people together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going around the world and having that experience and coming back to, like I said, coming back to Charlottesville, you really see how divided people are and divisive a lot of people want to be. The more I do my job, the more I'm like, I'm not sure people a lot of times actually want to be on things. They kind of want what they want.
Uh-huh.
It's having the perspective of there is commonality. There are differences, but there is commonality. As I move forward in my career as a planner, and that's going to shape it more, I want to be the type of person that allows people from different groups to collaborate, that allows them to come to the table, to allow everybody to be heard, and then go from what can we agree on? What can we all say yes to for the betterment of our city? Mm. Those are the ways in which I want to, the type of planner I want to be in the future, in the ways I want to grow really as a person, to be a collaborator, to be a convener, to be a peacemaker, for lack of a better word,
mm-hmm.
because I'm the kind of person that is comfortable with differences, is comfortable really being the other, and this is what I do traveling the world. And, you know, I'm an African-American female, and so only two of the countries I went to were distinctly black people, so I stuck out everywhere that I went. And I stick out here.
In Charlottesville, yes.
I stick out in Charlottesville because I'm often, not so much now, but definitely when I first got here, I was often the only African-American person in the room. And even at the churches that I've gone to, because I've gone to majority Caucasian churches, mm-hmm. and that you have to be comfortable in your skin,
yes.
and being the other. And then when you are the other, as I've traveled, you are sensitive to people that are dislike you, and hopefully I want to grow in that, and I want to be a convener, as a professional, and just as a person in the future, a peacemaker.
Well, it sounds like to me, at the very least, you are leading by example. And I mean leading all cultures, colors, educational levels, socioeconomic levels. You are a living example of what it can be when people cooperate, coordinate, and see the others as themselves. I mean, we really are all a reflection of each other, and if we could just grab that concept. But you certainly have, and just talking to you, just listening to you today, I'm going, wow, it's and this person is a city planner. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, really? Wow. So, and I've grown to love Charlottesville. It was difficult to sort of say goodbye to New York City. It had always been good to me. A lot of actors go there and wait tables. I had never had that have to do that. I was just blessed from the first day, and it just got better and better. But Charlottesville has always been a place I've come to for history, and always been aware, even before I moved here, that not all the history was being told. And I think that leaves such a gap, such a hole that we're missing stuff, you know, that we would be all the better if we just knew something about it or could experience it in some way.
Right.
And, well, I won't ramble on. We've sort of run out of time anyway, but this has been truly, truly a moving chat with Ebony Walden. And my goodness, what can we say?
Thank
you. She is a poet. She is a photographer. She's videographer. She's a catalyst for unity. And she's a city planner at Charlottesville, Virginia. So there. Thank you so much, Ebony, for talking with us today. We're definitely going to hear at least one more of your poems before we go today, and maybe two.
All right.
But thank you for being with us today.
And thank you.
Okay. Don't go away, anyone. We're going to say goodbye to Ebony, but we're going to listen to her poetry, and we'll be back for our panel discussion with, those reasonable voices in the studio with me today, technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Upperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. I thank you so very much for listening to Ebony Walden tell us a lot about what life can be. And we're going to say goodbye to her, but come right back, stay with us, and we're going to talk about some other wonderful things. Thanks again, Ebony. You have a great life.
Thank
Keep
you.
Doing it.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye.
Some peer into this abyss that appears abysmal and see just a big black hole. filled with burning trash, choking lungs with poisonous coal. But if you dig deep past the surface into the corners of the filthy folds, you will find that I am precious, a mind full of metallic treasures, glistening and bold. These are not valuables that you can at one glance behold, for you are blinded by the coat of soot, oblivious to the fact that I am a splendid formation filled with sparkling gold. Adversity has made me a masterful miner. Every day I chip away at the deprivation that tries to tarnish me down in this dreadful deep. I must avoid being swallowed by the sewage of slum streets. And you say, pardon me, how will you break free and be clean? And I say, with my mind's tool of creativity, I'll write music and poetry so that you can hear me speak. With the authority of a chief, I'll dance in the streets, bringing joy to my community and happiness to weary feet. On these streets, hungry children will feast. On walls tainted by travesty, my murals will paint prosperity and peace. Wrists and necks around the world will be adorned with my handcrafted beads. This is how we will cope. Those trash bags piled here in heaps, I'll make into handbags that hold dollar bills of hope. My creativeness can create colorful visions of change with nothing less than a pen, a paintbrush, a pair of hands, and this God-given craftiness.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. In the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with the Michelle Upperman and Danielle Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds now engaged who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today and every day that you do, and for recommending us to all your friends. We're going to talk today, you know, there's a lot going on. You know, Gates has written a tell-all book, and we've got Janet Yellen being appointed as the first female chair to the Fed. We have Hillary Clinton, of course, we're still wondering what she might do. We've recently had on the show Reverend Wade Clegg and his wife Elisheva Clegg, also Reverend, and their charity. But let's talk about gender. Let's talk about women in high places. Let's talk, Bernard.
Well, whenever the topic of women comes up, I find it interesting, mainly because I think we've lost the balance on how to talk about women, just like when people talk about affirmative action, in the sense that why is it when I go to whitehouse.gov, there's a drop-down menu that says economy, environment, women. I mean, there's literally a category.
Oh my God, are you serious?
No, there's literally a category on whitehouse.gov called women. And I understand that they're probably trying to say, well, we need to make sure that women have a category so that they feel not left out. But what they don't realize is that, like, it's just another form of
separating.
To object. It's like women become an issue to talk about versus a human being.
The only black history happens in February.
Right. I mean, imagine if I went to whitehouse.gov and under women it said black people. You know?
Yeah, what is that?
So I just think it's interesting that women have become more of an issue than people, even in the effort to try to make them people is what actually makes them less of people. Because, you know, why is it when we have candidates, it's always about, well, how do you feel about women? It's like, why is that a... when I think about life, I don't go around, you know, necessarily having, well, how do I feel about, you know, finance? And how do I feel about women? This is not like a category in my mind in that sense. How do I feel about women? I think they're beautiful, and I would like to talk to them. I think in those terms, but not just these, you know, characteristics that I can, you know, mark down on a list to kind of tell somebody in a structured format.
And yet it's all in the marketing. I mean, let's face it. I mean, of course, not just women, but teens and tweens, or what do they call pre-teens? So that's a tween. And women, of course, and how do you market this product to black people as opposed to Latinos?
Right.
It does come back to a lot of green that we were discussing in another show. But I hear what you're saying, Bernard. As the woman in the room?
Yes, the only female voice. That's what my... Anyways, so well, when it comes to, you know, women and kind of making it this topic, I thought about this a lot when I had a class with Daniel on the fiction. It was called The Fiction of Black Identity, which I thought was a really interesting class by a great professor, Professor Wolfork here at UVA. Mm. Often I thought to myself, how do you help a group of people or a demographic of people feel accomplished in what they've overcome without perpetuating or reminding everyone again that, hey, you once were not equal, you know, you once were not considered equal. You know, and I think the same issue, the same kind of question, or, I don't know, finding that balance is applies to the women issue, because I think maybe there's a tab for women because they're thinking, well, there has never been a female president, and that women used to not be able to vote, and, you know, women were often not allowed to be educated as much as males, blah, 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 blah. So there's a way in which it's like, so we should give them extra credit for some of the things they're doing, or, you know, but I think at the same time, for me personally, I think, you know, politicians-wise, I think more about what the person's saying, and if what they're saying is going to actually do something, you know, beneficial for a community rather than their gender. You know, so that's just something that I think that there's about. That's probably maybe why women is kind of considered an issue, but I also question why is it so brought to the forefront as such a big deal.
Well, I have an answer, a short answer, if I may.
Sure.
Why it's such a big deal, this is one way it is. As most people don't realize, and as Justice Scalia, how often do I quote Justice Scalia, has recently ruled, there is no specific constitutional equality recognizing the equality of women in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings, and the reason I'm big on this is because I have been hired as one of the feature writers for the Equal Rights Amendment that is all of maybe 20 words that just simply gives a blanket equality to all human beings who are American in the Constitution. But the only people who are missing that guarantee constitutionally are women. Blacks got it after the Civil War, and if you were rich, white, and owned property, you got it from the very beginning with the Declaration of Independence. Women do not have, they got the right to vote, but they never got constitutional equality. So it's not the only answer, but it is, and it's not even a justification. I mean, you and Bernard make a great point, but it is a fact that women are still dealing with.
Well, there's quite a lot. I think one of the issues is that women are stereotyped to do ABCD. They're to be sex symbols, to be domestic home. I've heard versions of feminism that are the hope to break down any sort of stereotype of what a woman is supposed to be. I've heard versions of feminism that are a lot like the Second Shift book, along the lines of if women have two jobs, they go to work, then they have to come home and take care of the family, and the male just sort of expects that to be the case. But on the flip side, feminism can then devalue women who want to be homemakers. There's a ditch on either side of the road. I think you have the women can have it all myth, but then you also have, like in the Atlantic, where it said, well, that woman came out with that article and said, you know, that's a myth and that's not good. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have it all. There's a ditch on anywhere you look. I think, too, there's a situation where women can feel victimized by particular pressures from men, like they're sexualized, they're idolized, but then at the same time, men can feel victimized by women for being told their entire lives that if they, you know, are masculine, if they're strong, if they grow up and they do the things that men are supposed to do, there's going to be a woman there for them, and they do all of those things, and then women reject them, so then both parties feel like victims. There are economic issues with women where women make less than the...
Which is still the case.
But to that, I always kind of pause, because if women are making less than men to do the same jobs, then I don't know why businesses ever hire men. They should just hire women, because they can get the same productivity from women.
Well, therein is another answer to Michelle's question. That's why... whether we like it or not, and Bernard's right. It's done for the wrong reasons. But women still are not equal in so many ways in the eyes of the men in power that maybe they do need a drop down.
I think we had a discussion not too long ago about, I think it was freedom and the Constitution, and how do you define it? Like, is the Constitution giving you rights, or is it just explaining the inherent rights? And I think the same, you know, idea comes up here when you talk about equality. Because if we really sat down and took the time to clearly separate things, I think we'd realize that no one is really... Okay, you're extreme person like a KKK or neo-Nazi, they're not for equality of human beings. Yeah. We don't even really pay those people any mind.
We hope not.
But I think the problem comes when you intersect humanity with the economy. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask a person, okay, there was a woman hit by a bus and a man hit by a bus and there's a doctor, who deserves to be saved? Most people are going to say, well, obviously they're both equally worthy to be kept alive. So it's never. I don't think the question ever really comes up when it's just talking about the human worth. Mm-hmm. It's when you get into the economic system where it's like, well, women are paid less than men, so they're less than men. But, you know, that's usually where the argument arises as soon as money comes into play. So I think it's just we have to really, really be careful and define what we're talking about with equality, because it's easy just to throw the words. Women aren't equal. Like, it's not true. Most people would say women are equal. But the expressions of it, like, in the economy don't seem to reflect that.
I don't think, although women might disagree with this statement, I don't think because you get paid less makes you... Well, actually, that's not true. I do think, at least in the eyes of those who are paying you less, they must think you are less. Mm-hmm. Whether they deal in terms of equality, human equality or not, they must think, they must value you less. Right. Otherwise, why would they do that? And still, there is still the legal issue that no matter how we, no matter what we say about we believe in the equality of every human being, male or female, regardless of age, gender, color, whatever, there still is a missing piece in the law of the land that makes that a legal statement. As given to us publicly by two Supreme Court justices whose job it is to interpret the Constitution of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Ginsburg was the other, by the way, hardly a conservative.
If businesses are either sexist or are paying women less, or they do not believe they get as much productivity out of women as they do men.
The old myth they're going to have a baby or...
Or something. Because, again, if businesses are getting as much productivity out of women as they are out of men, and they can pay them less, why would they ever hire men? Yes. You see what I'm saying?
I hear you.
So that's either they're getting less productivity or they're sexist. Mm-hmm. There's two options. Mm-hmm. It can vary from case to case. Now, I think, too, when we say things like women are not as based on what I just said, women are potentially not as productive as men, well, then everyone can put up their hands and say, well, that's terrible. How dare you say that women may not be as productive as men in the workforce? Well, it depends on what your definition of productive is. I think, without question, the most important jobs in society tend to belong to women. Without a home, there is no society. Mm-hmm. Without children, there is no society. Now, you don't want to reduce women to that, but the production of the household and the family and the well-being of those of whom the mother mothers, there is no society without these things. Now, the very fact that I just made that example to someone who has feminist leanings would just accuse me of having a bias, and now I'm reducing the women. You can't even say what I just said about the value of motherhood without getting bracketed. And that is, I think, one of the problems with this entire conversation. Yeah. Economic production. We had a conversation recently about how the economy is destroying the environment. So those, therefore, who do not contribute as much to the economic model that is destroying the planet are doing us a service. You know, it just depends on how you look at it. But also... personally, I much rather work with women than men. No. Men tend to be very egotistical. They tend to not listen. They don't work well in groups. I'm all about more women in the workforce. I'm serious. Men, most men are not good to work with. They're hard to communicate with. They're hard to talk with. I am all about having more women in the workforce by every stretch of the imagination. But I think, too, it doesn't do us any value to talk about equality without talking about real potential differences between races and genders. Mm-hmm. Not to define a given gender or a race within that paradigm, But in order to help us understand what are the puzzle pieces we're putting together to make an equal and beautiful whole of a different picture. Like, there are people like Bernard here, who is a master at freestyle. Mm-hmm. I'm not. The equality thus that the two of us will share must be aware of those differences, mm-hmm. so that we're not lost and reduced, as you said at the beginning, Bernard, into an issue in the effort of trying to get along.
I hear what you're saying, and I think everyone's more than an issue, but I do think that I want to, since you brought up both we're talking gender, we're talking equality, we're talking constitution, and now we've introduced race, I want to mention someone who's from the area, a graduate from the University of Virginia, and I'd like to get this name correct if I could. I'm going off the top of my head, no script here, but I believe it's Sashiva Zamata is a 2009 graduate from the University of Virginia. She happens to be a black woman, and she is going to begin on Saturday, January 18th. Will make her debut on Saturday Night Live. Speaking of issues and people being objectified, would she have that job if she weren't black and weren't female? And how do we feel?
As you were bringing it up, I mean, like I said, I think it's very interesting when something like this happens.
Yeah.
How everybody
that's what we're
immediately
talking
about. Homes,
yeah.
She's black
and she's a woman.
It's like that becomes the defining thing in a way.
Well, it is for SNL because they've been under pressure, but the woman is incredibly talented.
Right.
I know people who know her. Remember, Michelle, you know her, right?
Well, I have a mutual friend who does know her, but she was with the UVA theater,
the theater department here
and the dance department.
Yes.
So
she's good.
But to me, the question is, why does this pressure come? You know, why do people have to feel pressure to involve women and black people, you know, or anybody else? Because it says that, well, we want you because there's this outside perception that you should have things so you can appear diverse,
mm-hmm.
when really you should want to be diverse because it makes your show more interesting and will make you the most attractive show.
Right. That's right.
But rather it starts at the other end where it's like, well, put on this facade of diversity and then you look good to people and then they praise you.
Right.
So, I mean, I think It can go both ways. I think it's just like when, you know, Obama was elected. It's because it's such a rare thing that happened.
Yeah.
It's natural to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously people are going to make mention of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the big question is, like, when are we going to get to the point where I can say Barack Obama is the first black president, and I say that because it's pure fact.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
right.
Or he's the first president to wear Nike shoes.
Exactly.
You know, it's as mundane as that.
Right.
No, I think when the culture stresses having people come to your college and creating diversity, or on SNL, it's the first black woman. Well, in a way, there's a sense, I don't know what she's thinking, but you want to know when you get hired for something that it's pure talent and ability, and even to have the possibility in the back of your mind that maybe I got the edge because I'm a black woman,
mm-hmm.
would then kind of rob you of the sort of joy that, say, a white male could get if they got the same role, because they would know it was pure talent and pure ability. Even in the effort to try to diversify, if you do it in the way that you're saying you shouldn't,
mm-hmm.
Bernard, you create that kind of in the back of your mind, that mental, well, shoot, maybe I'm only, you know, maybe I know I'm talented, but maybe what ultimately got it was that extra little edge. And that is, I think that's a disservice to do to people that are, to her, who is extraordinarily talented.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have African-American kids who are getting accepted to college, they shouldn't have to spend 4 years in the back of their heads wondering if there's the possibility that they got in because of affirmative action. You know, I understand that there is inequality in existence, but that is, there's always trade-offs, right? If you create that initiative of diversity, you do create that psychology, rather you intend to or not.
I think that's true. Forgive me for interrupting.
Oh,
it's someone very close to me who at least 4 times a year will mention that she wonders, she doesn't even wonder, I think she assumes that she got her position as a professor because She's both female and Asian.
And that's what they had to
And
I don't know if you can overcome racial and sexist concerns if that psychology still exists in some of your members of the society.
But you know, the bottom line, we've got to give the only woman in the room the last word here. But the bottom line is, whether we like it or not, whether it is necessary, if a society will not be the wonderful people we want everyone to be, then someone has to impose goodness on us, perhaps. Michelle.
Yeah. Well, imposing goodness. I mean, I think goodness should really come, hopefully.
Well, yes.
And I know what you're saying. It's a hard thing to know what's right here. But, I mean, I think if you have, you know, quotas, you're not changing people's hearts. You're changing charts.
Yeah.
You know, you're just changing it on paper. And you're not allowing people to really see that, yes, what was in the past was wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, but we don't need to harp on that anymore. You know, we need to really see people for, you know, just
who they really are,
who they are, and that they have, like, when I heard about Sashiva, I was like, that's so awesome, that's amazing, good for her, you know, she must be amazingly talented. I didn't think, like, oh, she's a female and she's black, I bet she got in because of that, you know, but I think the hope is that our hearts and our outlook and our view of people would not just be about to recognize that, yes, they do have a race that's different than mine, and it's beautiful,
mm-hmm.
but not to think about, you know, where they stand in society or what they were able to achieve because of it, because maybe they had some leg up because of,
mm-hmm.
you know, affirmative action or something, you know? So I think it's tricky. It's hard to know how to get people to do that naturally, but, you know, I hope we can all strive toward that.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I agree.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today and recommending us to all of your friends. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping that you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.